Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I want to tell you about a new way to get the news each morning. Up First is the morning news podcast from NPR. Give us 10 minutes or so and you get a sense of the stories and big ideas of the day. The stuff you really need to know and why it matters. Start your day with Up First, weekday mornings by 6 a.m. Eastern Time on the NPR One app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're speeding and flying and crashing into the blockbuster, The Fate of the Furious. Plus, a discussion of clapbacks and feuds from our recent Chicago Live show with our pal Sam Sanders. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
Now, we have to tell you that our pal Glenn Weldon has an unbroken streak of seeing zero Fast and the Furious movies, and he was eager to keep that streak alive. So we brought two of our friends in with us to talk about the film. First, from NPR's Code Switch, is Gene Demby. Hi, Gene.
Woot. Thank you for having me.
And of course, in our other fourth chair is our special punching and exploding and space and robot correspondent.
Who fancies himself the Jason Statham of the PCHH squad, if not the Scott Eastwood.
That's right. True on both counts. Chris Klimek. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Linda.
It's always good to have you. It's always good to have Gene.
To be here.
I'm excited about this alignment of people to discuss this very, very special film.
Well, we were last all together discussing The Force Awakens, the movie that has now been stomped box office-wise.
That's right.
Fate of the Furious.
That's right, because this weekend, while some of you were gearing up for HBO shows like Girls and Veep, a whole lot of other people were making The Fate of the Furious, the eighth installment in the car racing franchise, the biggest global opening weekend at the box office for any movie ever. Here in the U.S., it made significantly less on its opening weekend than Furious 7, but big international numbers more than compensated for that. The film stars Vin Diesel, Dwayne Johnson, Michelle Rodriguez, Tyrese Gibson, Ludacris, and not for nothing, Charlize Theron as the villain. So to the degree there's a plot, here it is. Dominic Toretto, he's the one played by Vin Diesel, is basically extorted into turning against his own team and working with the bad guys. That means it's up to his friends to track him down and stop him without, you know, letting him blow up the world. It's directed by F. Gary Gray, who did Friday and Straight Outta Compton, and it does contain, spoiler alert, car crashes. I have a long-standing, by which I mean two movie, history in the past of seeing these with Chris. Chris and I saw 6 and 7 together.
We did. And I think just sitting next to you, it's like the recliner theater, you know, mitigating factor for
right.
me in Fast and Furious films. And when I have to see them alone.
As you did with this one.
Well, I sat next to Bob Mondello.
Oh, sure.
Similarly.
Yes. And no, it was different, Linda.
It wasn't the same. You reviewed this film for NPR.org.
I did.
And you didn't like it, which makes me so sad.
I know. And I know it's me, everyone.
Just discuss with me your resentments and bad feelings.
I think I have nothing wrong with a dumb action movie. Who loves a dumb action movie more than I do, right? But I mean, this franchise has become the ambassador for the entire genre. And I just feel like it reflects poorly on it. I feel like this is the one that takes, you know, all of the rigor and all of the, you know, I mean, we're all here to watch things explode and watch conflict, hand-to-hand fights and stunts and stuff. But whenever there is a creative choice to be made, I feel like this franchise takes the most obvious or really the most derivative choice.
But you feel like you want your car crash movies, and I'm not mocking here at all. You want your car crash exploding movies to have an idea.
I want the whackassery to have a guiding intelligence.
Yes.
All for whackassery, but I don't want it to be haphazard.
I think that's fair.
I want it to be someone has really thought about this.
All right. How about you, Gene? What do you think?
My strong, very strong, vehement pushback to that would be I've never seen a movie in which a Lamborghini was chased by a Soviet nuclear submarine.
That's true.
Derivative of my ass. No. It was funny because I saw the movie with my girlfriend who has never seen any of them. I think I've seen three or four of them. Uh-huh. And she kept asking me questions like, why is this happening? I was like, those are the wrong questions to ask in this movie. It's weird because it feels like a critic-proof movie, like in a lot of ways. Like,
how dare you?
No, it clearly is.
These movies make a ton of money, right? And there isn't anything sort of stringing together, right? I mean, the franchise has like had this weird creep in which it was originally about these car thieves, right? And in this movie, it's about, I guess, stopping
nuclear war,
right? Mm-hmm. I mean, with American-made muscle cars.
I mean, it is like the Bond franchise in that it just keeps pulling in whatever is hot at the time, mm-hmm. you know? And I like that. And like anything this long-lived is going to do that. But it doesn't much, like how much racing is there even in this, there's the Havana Street Race at the mm-hmm. very beginning of this movie, I think is by far the best part for mm-hmm. me because I could follow it. There seemed to be a real element of physical risk to it.
Yeah.
You know, and that increasingly evaporates as the film goes on.
So where do you come down, Gene?
There are moments of like that were actually funny, right? There was a scene in which Jason Statham is fighting with a baby, which is
not fighting against the baby,
fighting the boss baby,
fighting Alec Baldwin. That was actually like kind of clever. I mean, it went on too long, as a lot of things in these movies do. And there are obviously like tons of things that don't make any sense. It's not clear why these people who drive cars are like special forces agents. I'm not sure exactly why they were conscripted by, you know, like, I mean,
why Tyrese Gibson is a Green Beret or whatever.
Who seems to be bad at everything.
Right. That's the right. joke.
That's the joke.
But the thing is like the movie is like stacked with people who are really charming and charismatic, and Vin Diesel too. And
There it is.
It's true.
There's like, you know, it's Charlize Theron is like throwing her back. She's like really chewing, just noshing on everything inside, just all mm-hmm. the scenery. The Rock is super charismatic. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of stuff going for it, even if it doesn't, a lot of it does not work. I mean, a lot of it does not make any sense.
No, right.
But you almost can't, like, watch this movie with that sort of lens.
Yeah. I'm with you, Gene. I think every criticism that I can mount against this movie can be rebutted with one of two arguments. One, it made a fortune. Two, dude, it's a Fast and the Furious movie. Mm-hmm. That said, I really wish it had been smarter. I felt like they didn't have to make it smarter, and so they just didn't. And so you have a lot of action set pieces. You have a couple of really good action set pieces. I think you're right. The car chase scene in Havana is terrific. Havana, the home of women in booty shorts.
Yes. And the part where Vin Diesel tells the Cuban, never lose your Cuban spirit. Never lose your Cuban spirit.
Thank you for explaining the Cuban spirit, yeah, Vin Diesel.
Two Cubans. But the Charlize Theron character, you've brought in an A-list actor mm-hmm. to play the part of the villain. And then you give her nothing. She is reciting lines out of the encyclopedia of action movie cliches. Every single thing she says is a cliche. There's this very, very talky midsection of this movie that I found so boring. This movie manages to be dumb and Byzantine at the same time. I just found myself like, I was there for it. I was game for it. I'd had kind of a long, hard day and just kind of was ready to throw myself into it and occasionally was able. I mean, there's a big car chase sequence that takes place on ice. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I really thought the script was rough and that kept kind of pulling me out of like, wee, cars.
My favorite thing that happens when I'm watching a Fast and Furious movie is that I literally sit in my chair and I go, yay! And the closest I came in this movie is there's a part where these cars are coming out of windows.
Yes.
That was my closest.
The most convoluted evil plot
ever. Of course,
ever.
Of course. Yeah,
right.
But that was the part where I was like, yay! Yeah. And it's the same as like in the previous movie, the stuff where they jump through one building in a car to another building.
Right.
And so I will say this one had fewer of those kind of, to me, super inventive action moments that I do think it has sometimes had. Like, Chris argues that it doesn't usually, but I would say, for example, in the last one, I think it was, that the cars all came down in parachutes.
Right.
That was cool.
No, that was cool. And there is something about the way these movies are edited. And I mean, like, Justin Lin has made mm-hmm. four of these. He's the only director who's made more than one, I'm pretty sure. This one was F. Gary Gray, like you said. But there is something about the style of editing where even the stunts that are accomplished practically kind of look like they've been digitally fudged. And
that's
cannot
right.
explain that. Like, I know that the sub chase at the climax of this mm-hmm. movie was largely practical. The parachute thing, like, I watched the behind the scenes featurette on that. Like, I thought that was all animated mm-hmm. when I was watching the movie. And it's like, wait, no, they actually
actually did this? Why doesn't it? You know, so there is this weird point in filmmaking now where it is harder and harder to tell, and harder for filmmakers to give you that weight in reality. But when you see something like Mad Max Fury Road, and you're like, how did 200 people not die making this movie? Mm-hmm. You know, it does have something that these movies, the Fast and Furious movies, just don't.
So here's how I come out on this. I can't take issue with any of Chris's criticisms of it or Steven's criticisms of it. They're all valid. I am not a person who believes, you know, it doesn't matter whether action movies are smart. To me, there is no bigger insult to deliver to the work that somebody does than to answer criticism of it by saying, lighten up.
Right.
Because what that means is you're right about it, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I would never say lighten up to either one of you because you're absolutely right. And I care whether action movies are smart.
However,
having this, I have this weird, it's like my silly movie kryptonite. I don't know what it is, but there's like a keyhole in my heart that is shaped like Fast and Furious movies. And it is not, that keyhole cannot be accessed by other silly action movies or by other Vin Diesel movies or by other The Rock movies. Mm-hmm, yeah. It's only this. And I say that despite the fact that I think the badness of Vin Diesel in these movies is
profound.
Yeah. And I understand somebody said to us on Twitter when we were talking about this movie, the fact that Vin Diesel was in The Iron Giant for a lot of people means like he's set for life. Yeah. I would never criticize
that. That has largely been true of me.
I get it. However, in these movies, the thing he tries to do with this guy is so awkward and weird to me. And he's getting, like Gene said, there are so many people in this movie who are so charismatic, including people who really do very little in it. In this one, like Ludacris does not do very much, but he's fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tyrese Gibson does more, although I still, again, do not understand that character because he's bad at everything. And yet they keep bringing him.
What did you guys think of Scott Eastwood?
Sure looks like his dad.
I thought he was cute. And I had a conversation with our fine producer, Jessica Reedy, where she took the position that he was fairly low on the charisma chart.
I am on team Jessica.
But I will say this. I do think there's something to be said, particularly when you look at that global box office. I give this franchise credit for the fact that from the beginning, it has been kind of effortlessly, silently diverse, which is something that people bring up about this movie whenever they talk about the global appeal. But I will say, I mean, I do think there's something to be said for the fact that without talking about it very much, without making a big deal out of it. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, I mean, Paul Walker, who I very much enjoyed watching in movies, not only in these movies,
big
but in
Snow Dogs in fan,
a couple other movies. Right. Paul Walker passing away means, in a lot of ways, their biggest white dude is the one who's not in these films anymore. Mm-hmm. So I do respect that about this franchise. And I think there are ways in which that's the kind of thing that representation-wise is sometimes more important than kind of, or at least as important as big, like serious, thoughtful things is making sure that even when you're making kind of things that are not put together with a tremendous amount of brain power, that the cast seems like it is part of like a global world.
I think F. Gary Gray, I think, became the first black director to the highest grossing.
I think that's right. Yeah.
The highest grossing opening ever by African American director was this movie.
Yeah.
F. Gary Gray's directed.
He has had a really interesting career.
Very much.
Didn't he do some NWA videos and stuff
He did the Italian Job.
Right, with Charlize Theron.
I am very much looking forward to more Fast and Furious movies in my future. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. We know some of you saw Fate of the Furious. We know you did. You're out there. You saw Fate of the Furious. It's a safe space. Talk to us about it. Or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you thought. Now, when we come back, you are going to get to hear a part of our live show from Chicago that we did with our friend Sam Sanders, where we talked about clapbacks and feuds. It was pretty good. All right, we will be right back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Columbia Records, presenting John Mayer's new album, The Search for Everything, the first collection of new songs from the Grammy-winning artist in 4 years, including the singles Love on the Weekend and Still Feel Like Your Man. Available now.
Now, this is something that if you follow Sam, you've heard Sam talk about this, I'm going to say.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about clapbacks and feuds.
A beautiful thing.
A beautiful thing. Sam, before we get started,
I'm going to go to you because of your experience in this matter.
So, I mean, you can probably kind of intuit what a clapback would mean. I think of it as like a rapid response, usually given with anger, in a public way or in a public space. Urban Dictionary defines it as simply to return fire. I like that. So that's my working definition.
Right. So you wrote a piece recently about Twitter threads and tweet storms. Talk a little bit about the connection between that and a clapback.
Yes. So I've been obsessed with tweet threads and tweet storms, especially the recent spate of all of these dudes who have really deep thoughts about Russian political conspiracies. And the threads are probably like 1,000 tweets long. So I dug really deep into this for a while and wrote about 1,600 words on the art, science, culture, and language of tweet threads. Yeah. Probably 1,000 words too many, but I don't care.
So let's talk about an example of a clapback in the form of a tweet storm.
Yes.
You have a favorite,
I think. I've been obsessed with how clapback culture, which is like this word and the idea of clapback, comes directly from hip-hop culture and reality TV show culture and black culture, but now it is everywhere in the way that like shade, which was this really gay word, is now everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun to see it used, but also weird when people misuse it.
Right,
like
sure.
People are like, oh my God, Donald Trump just bombed Syria. Shade. Yeah. No, not that. Anyways, my favorite political clapback of note recently came from an investigative journalism outfit called ProPublica. They responded to one press secretary named Sean Spicer, White House press secretary. He called them a little left-wing blog, and they responded beautifully. The text is quite small.
Could you read us the entire...
read the whole thing. Well, the first one just sets the tone. Like, could you imagine a newsroom with the stature of ProPub talking like this 10 years ago? I love how having to clap back on Twitter really kind of sharpens your language. I talked to several linguists over the course of doing this way too long web piece on tweet storms, and they found a few things. One, besides making everything have to go faster on Twitter, people live in this really interesting space between written and spoken word when they tweet and when they thread. And that is fun, and that moves the language forward. One guy said that they are in this weird space of orality. Yeah. Approaching orality, but not quite. And you see it evidenced when people do things like tweet in all caps. That's like you're yelling. Or when they have a little emoji with the this thing. Whatever that is.
Yeah.
I love it, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first thing I find really interesting.
Yeah.
The second thing is that like when you are clapping back in a thread, every tweet needs to be like 4 score and 7 years ago. Every tweet has to hit, right? Because you don't know if... you know, some rando on Twitter is going to see tweet 1 or tweet 342.
Yeah. And there's nothing quite like doing even like a short series of tweets and like a whole bunch of people like the first one and nobody likes the second one.
Oh, it's
like,
really, it's disheartening.
I lost them on the second one.
Yes, yes.
It's very depressing.
Yeah. Well, and then I find myself doing this thing where I want to make sure that everyone knows this is part of a thread. So I'll number all of them, then I'll dot, dot, dot. Then I'll have C-O-N-T in parentheses. Be like, continue, keep going. Right. Stay with me.
Yeah.
All the folks that I talked to said that like the art of the clapback online, the art of tweeting and threading online pushes language in this weird way forward.
Yeah.
But overall, even if it's helping language, it's not really helping the discourse.
Yeah.
For one big reason, when you have a clapback or a feud or a feuded thread or storm online, everyone and their mom gets involved.
Yeah. So I want to talk about your other example.
Yes.
Because the ProPublica one is an example of kind of like organization on public figure, right?
Exactly.
And it's more in the field of like talking about like a bigger
idea.
Right?
Basically saying we have receipts.
And then
we do our job.
Right. But there are also ones that are more one-on-one.
One-on-one,
like
just
person
petty.
To person.
Just petty. Like there's a great example this week. Or last week, I forget. Bill O'Reilly of Fox News infamy and Don Lemon of CNN infamy. So we all know what Bill O'Reilly's been going through. He has a situation at the moment, right?
That's one way to put it.
Yeah. So he tweeted this about Don Lemon. CNN's Don Lemon refuses to cover Susan Rice story. He then shares a link to his own website because, you know, plug. Don Lemon hashtag clapped back and it was like, my God. Do we have that slide? He says, false. I did not refuse to cover the story, but I did cover your sexual harassment allegations. Did you? This is peak clapback because it is peak Real Housewives.
Yeah.
This is like Teresa calling someone a prostitution whore about to flip the table.
Yep.
Like, yeah, it is so interesting for me to see the way in which public debate and conflict across all the culture has just kind of become reality.
Right, but we talked about how this one attracted a lot of attention and ultimately a participant we found unexpected.
Yes, so the other thing about the clapback online is that everyone and their mother gets involved, right? Which I love. But you end up with some really weird folks involved. My favorite response to this was a one-word tweet that said, "Finish him, Don." But guess who this came from, you guys? This came from the Twitter account for the really lovely website, Letters of Note. Really, so like, I tried to think of a way to conceptualize this. So they also responded and said one other one that just said zing. Like, they clapped back more than once in a thread that they were not involved in, that no one asked them to be in. But I kind of liken it to, you know, all of those late 90s teenage, senior year of high school movies where there's a house party that's gone out of control. And before you know it, you're like, who is in my house? Mm-hmm. That's the online clapback. My favorite way to compare it, so some of you might know this video, some of you might not. There is a Janet Jackson music video from her album The Velvet Rope for a song called Go Deep. And in the video, who remembers the video? Raise your hand. It's a great video, but it's also a house party gone crazy. But before you know it, by the end of the house party, some rando goes to the laundry room, puts too much detergent in the washing machine, bubbles are all over, and it becomes a foam party. I like to imagine Letters of Note is a dude at the party with the box of Tide quietly muttering, "Finish him, Don."
So Sam likes some of the one-on-ones. And we were also talking this week about the fact that some of the one-on-ones come up in, Stephen had a particular context. Do you have a particular context in which you have seen some feuding?
Well, in which I prefer to see some feuding.
Right.
Because, you know, I am from the old school.
Yeah.
I prefer my pop culture feuds to play out in more traditional settings. Like, mm-hmm. where would Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr have it out if they were to duel figuratively today? And clearly the answer is the VMAs.
Yeah.
Agreed.
And so, you know, every year we've got to cover them. And you realize that the history of the VMAs is just a history of, like, Tommy Lee and Kid Rock beating each other up in the aisles. And I was sort of thinking about, like, what is it about awards shows in general that make them a little bit more conducive to some of this feuding and clapping back that we're talking about. And it occurred to me that if your life, like, if everybody you know, if all your exes were in one room and they were drunk, and it was on TV. That is the VMAs. And so, like,
and it's so, also season 32 of The Real World, Seattle.
There we go.
And so we brought this handy visual aid, which for those of you listening on the podcast, you can't see it. It's Nicki Minaj. She wants to know, Miley, what's good? And that is ultimately, like, awards shows in general are supposed to be, like, awarding excellence. And it's a place for the industry to gather and give out trophies to the finest among us.
But how many awards shows are really that? You know what I mean?
The, like, Oscars.
The Grammys,
and that's it.
Are just a really long concert.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not that good.
Right.
The Oscars are just whatever the Oscars are. Right.
The Tonys are real.
The Tonys are awesome.
Yeah, the Tonys,
I'd never watch them.
Are that.
Yeah. The Tonys are if you liked your family. It's
yeah.
a family reunion where you liked your family.
It's like if all your friends got to have an award show and you were like, you're great. No, you're great.
Yeah.
That's the Tonys.
And you're also like celebrating the concept of the party existing in the first place.
Right, exactly. Because
you're like, you know what's amazing? What we do. Whereas the VMA.
They don't want us to have our party. But the Tonys are like the DJ Khaled of award shows. They're like, they don't want you
to have this party.
Bless up.
They don't want you to be in theater. Bless up. Go ahead, Thompson.
So you get, like, through the course of the VMAs, I mean, I it's easy to think of feuds at the VMAs. You know, we all have fairly short cultural memories, I think, when the VMAs are concerned. But it goes back, like 1992, Axl Rose and Kurt Cobain feuded at the VMAs.
I did not know that.
In, I think it's, I want to say 2007, Eminem feuded with Moby. And... Oh. And
what does that look like?
It's a very unfair fight, yeah. Intellectually.
Oh.
And it culminated in Eminem getting into a physical altercation with Triumph
That's
the Insult Comic
yes.
Dog.
Yes, I knew it was okay.
And I feel like when you found yourself fighting with Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. You have lost the battle and the war.
It's like in Greece when you take your second to the race. Like, so Triumph the Insult Comic Dog was Moby's second.
Finish him, Triumph.
But like, don't the VMAs want, like, I've always found them to just be a drunken mess.
Yeah.
Like, I don't take them seriously.
The VMAs have really no reason to exist other than creating some sort of viral moment. And
if nobody acted like a maroon at the VMAs, it would not exist anymore, right?
I mean, it would really bum me out to have to live tweet it.
We have been talking about the great pleasures to be taken in some of these feuds and clapbacks. As always, I go to Glenn for feelings.
Yeah. By applause, how many, when a big celebrity feud pops up, how many of you are all in, you eat it up with a big old spoon, you're Michael Jackson with a Thriller popcorn. By applause. Now, still using the applause as vote system, how many of you, whenever a celebrity feud pops up, how many of you find the whole thing highly unseemly? By applause. All right. Not for nothing, but those of you who applauded the second time, you and I are better people than the people who applauded the first time. Now,
see,
no,
that itself was a clapback.
Yeah, well, hold on. Don't get me wrong, we are humorless Calvinist scolds. We are sticks in the collective mud, but we're better people. I mean, here's the thing.
We've got letters of note.
We've got letters of note. Just chiming in.
Yeah.
I live to avoid conflict. Conflict makes me uneasy, and it's you know, this is not how I was raised. The public airing of grievances, I was raised, if you have any, you take any insults, you take any anger, and you swallow it, and you die with it. You die early, quietly, and wracked with unspoken resentment. I'll give you an example. Okay, so I am ride or die for RuPaul's Drag Race. As all are right-thinking Americans. You couldn't pay me to watch Untucked. Don't want to see Untucked. Untucked is the show that's behind the scenes where the queens basically just go at each other. And whenever I see two drag queens just going at each other, it makes me feel like mom and mom are fighting.
Yeah.
And I should probably unpack that in therapy, not here. But here's what I resent about it. Just heard myself say that. Here's what I resent about it, .com. Which is
sponsored by Letters of
Note.
Yeah.
Old Man Weldon is the website. Here's what I resent about it is my newsletter. It asks you, and I want to hear from you guys. I think it, any kind of public feud like that asks you to engage with it in the same way that you're asked to engage with the work itself, right? All the noise around it. We are implicitly called upon to not be able to separate it from the work. I think Don Henley said it best. Our modern day Ovid, the immortal bard of Dallas-Fort Worth, he said, we can do the innuendo. We can dance and sing. When it's all said and done, we haven't told you a thing. We all know the crap is king. Give us dirty laundry.
The what?
Dirty laundry.
Oh. One of the worst songs.
Ever
recorded. We did an episode of All Songs Considered, What is the Worst Song of All Time? And Carrie Brownstein brought with her the song Dirty Laundry by Don Henley.
Yep.
And she's right.
If you listen to it, it is basically Don Henley going, take that, the media. And he thinks that there's a lot more invective in that song than there actually turns out to be. Mm-hmm. But yes.
That's one of the things I think is interesting is when it's in the actual, like when it's in the actual work itself, not the VMAs and not Twitter, but when it's like in the art, right? Not just songs like that, but like there are a ton of people who, I mean, I don't want to bring Taylor Swift into everything, but
bring her in.
She could have entire albums that are like, so I dated this guy. And that's the whole record. And like, and every song on it is like, I also dated this guy. And then there's a moment where it's like, and critics, music critics, and then there's a song about that. But like, to me, when it's in the work, I tend to find it usually off-putting, unless it's done like very, it has to be done like very lightly. And I was talking to you guys about the fact that I've talked a ton on the show about the many TV projects of Aaron Sorkin, and one of the things that's interesting to me is that he's done three that are about television, right? Sports Night and Studio 60 and The Newsroom. And the latter, Sam loves The Newsroom. Yeah. Ask him about it anytime. The latter two, Studio 60 and The Newsroom, are the ones that to me are the most steeped in resentment. They're the ones that are the most axe grindy, because by then he has more TV experience and he's angrier about TV and he's angrier about media. So it all strikes me as a bunch of axe grinding. Whereas on Sports Night, there's definitely like a creative people always have to fight the man, but it felt like it was a little bit more elegant. And there's a moment late in Sports Night, which is about the production of a Sports Center like show called Sports Night. So it's both the show inside the show and it's the actual sitcom comedy drama, whatever it was. Anyway. There's a moment at the end when Sports Night itself, the ABC show, was coming to an end, and there's a scene in a bar between Felicity Huffman and Clark Gregg, actually, who was playing the mysterious guy who might save the show, the inside the show. And she says something about how she loves her show, but it's going to die, and it turns out that he's trying to save her show. And he says to her, and this is in, I think, the penultimate episode of Sports Night that there ever was. He says to her, anybody who can't make money off of Sports Night should get out of the money-making business. And that is very clearly not only Sorkin talking about the Inside the Show, but it's also an opportunity to be like remarkably direct. But that show by then had earned it. Right. And so to me, if you've earned it, you can get away with it more. But when it's just axe grinding, and that goes for whether, like if it's grinding an axe against your band, like, I don't want that in a song. Like, and it partly depends on whether you can, like, if I notice it, I don't like it. But if I don't notice it because you work it into the song, then that's fine. If you want to be secretly mad, that's fine. Secret resentment.
Oh my God!
We're getting on the same page here, old man Weldon.
Yeah, that's my blog.
Yeah.
But getting back to songwriting, like writing a song is about trying to relate to and connect with your audience in a way, and like Don Henley lashing out about the media is not going to be terribly meaningful, especially in 1982 when that song came out. There was a John Fogerty song, and John Fogerty's certainly done his share of lashing out at his band, but he had a song called Zans Can't Dance in like 1985 or so. And it was referencing the industry mogul Saul Zants. And I just imagine... Okay. I just imagine like the kids at home rocking out to take that Saul Zants, suck it.
Yeah.
Or like Michael Jackson had a song that was like, you know, paparazzi messing with me. And it's like, nobody knows what that's like except you.
Well, it's like all of the rappers who were always mad at their labels.
Right.
They always need their headphones turned up. And two, they always have beef with their label. And it's like, your label's being pretty good to you. You know?
Right.
I also wonder, like, how much of the clapback, like in the Miley Nikki sense of the word, is purely performative.
Oh, right.
Oh, sure, like, some of it is.
All of it, and so like.
Wait, are you suggesting that Miley Cyrus and Nicki Minaj have some sort of gift for provocation?
What? Well, and like that's why I don't have as much of a problem with it as Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
No shade.
Yeah.
Like I just don't. I don't think most of it's real, right?
Yeah.
I feel like, especially a rapper like Nicki Minaj, she is giving us a performance of like multiple alter egos, multicolored wigs. Like, it's all about excess. So I would only assume that these clapbacks and these feuds are purely performative, which allows me to enjoy them even more.
Right, but yeah. Okay, so they're performative, but with Sorkin, there's nothing performative there. What he's doing is he's couching it in idealism. So Sports Night is the perfect sports show. West Wing is the perfect way to run the government, and the newsroom is the perfect way to run a newsroom.
But newsroom is the worst way to run a newsroom.
Of course.
They're all running right up to deadline and not having stuff figured out, and they all sleep with each other. That is awful. That is a horrible way to run a newsroom.
That's not how it works on the politics team.
Let me tell you, that's totally not how it works.
Yeah. I'm writing that NPR fanfic myself.
Nice.
All right. Well, we want to hear what all of you think about clapbacks and feuds. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us. So we will be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from STX Films' The Circle, starring Emma Watson, Tom Hanks, John Boyega, Patton Oswalt, Karen Gillan, and Bill Paxton. Based on the best-selling novel by Dave Eggers, The Circle is a gripping and provocative new thriller. Screenplay by James Ponsoldt and Dave Eggers. Directed by James Ponsoldt. See it April 28th, only in theaters.
We do, as always, want to end our show by talking about what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I wanted to talk about a YouTube video that's popped up in the last couple days from, and maybe other people have done it, but from a YouTube user named Dan Ketchum, who the clip from the Sean Spicer press conference, wherein he talks about, among other things, Holocaust centers, and takes the video and sets it as the closing credits for Veep. And so you just have like that soft little. I was watching, and it just made me laugh and laugh and laugh. And I was thinking, God, music is such an incredibly evocative thing. That the show Veep, just by through repetition, through the use of that little score over its closing credits, has created the universal sound of failure. And I was thinking about it used to be that the universal sound of failure, if you were just falling on your face, you would think like Yakety Sax, you know, like from the Benny Hill theme.
For a while, it was a Curb theme, right?
Sure.
Yes.
But that's kind of been usurped, it seems.
Not to be.
At least in this this beautiful, beautiful case. So the mashup between the Sean Spicer press conference and the closing credits of Veep.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Three things real quick. I walked around the Loop today, which was good. Because we went to the same nursery school. This will connect in a second. We went to the same nursery school. It was a very bucolic little carriage house, right? Very, very sweet, run by Quakers. I was then thrust into Penwood Elementary, which was a big, giant elementary school. And that set off my anxiety to such a degree that the only way I could deal with it was by imagining that I was in the opening credit montage of the Bob Newhart Show. I had my little briefcase. Yeah, and I walked around, and as it was going from plastic...
A little briefcase, you said?
Yeah, I did. I had your crayons, your construction paper, and your action figures, pretty much everything you need. So I walked around as a kid, just imagining myself, you know, going up, and that's what I did today. I just did that. Didn't have the briefcase, but I got to realize that moment. That's one. Aww. Two, there's a really good graphic novel just came out, by Kathy Malkasian. It's called Eartha, E-A-R-T-H-A. It is not a biographical comic of Eartha Kitt, so let's take a moment and mourn that. But it is this beautiful story about a woman who lives in a land where dreams grow out of the ground. They are the dreams of people in a faraway city. And one day, the dreams stop coming, so she goes on a journey to figure out why. It is so sad and absurd and weird and just richly melancholy and gorgeous. So it's from Fantagraphics book, just came out. Seek it out. Eartha by Kathy Malkasian. And finally, Here in Chicago, it is called 90 Miles Cuban Cafe.
Wow.
Went today with a Cuban. It is Faustino approved. There's a couple Cuban places in D.C. that are trying to kind of spruce it up, do a little twist on it. This is just authentic. Specifically, the Medianoche at 90 Miles Cuban Cafe. The bread is perfect. And the bread, if you know anything about Cuban sandwiches, the bread is all important. And it was just incredibly good. So the 90 Miles Cuban Cafe.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Sam Sanders, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I have a thing, but because I love Chicago and their sports teams and their food, I'm going to start by saying that I also had a lovely meal in Chicago. For the past few times that I've been in this city, one of my first stops is the lovely restaurant, The Girl and the Goat. Went again yesterday, was not disappointed. It's just great, y'all. It's really good. Two other small things. Season 2 of Chewing Gum is brilliant.
Yep.
Binge it in one day. Season 6 of Girls has been brilliant. Sidebar, Hannah Horvath, a.k.a. Elena Dunham, has become a really great actress. Like, she's just really good at it now. And she can convey all this kind of emotion just with her face and, like, no words at all. She's great. So that. But my big thing that's making me happy this week is revisiting some of the more obscure tracks from Prince's career as we approach the anniversary of his death. Like all of you, I'm a really big Prince fan. Fun side note, the day of Prince's death, you and I, Stephen, went and did a live Facebook Live video to talk about him. And that whole grieving process for me was weird because that day I had to talk about it on the Politics Podcast, talk about it with you. And then I wanted to have a Prince party to celebrate his life and his music the next Saturday. And that was the same night the new Beyonce album dropped.
Yeah.
So it was like a funeral and a birth ceremony on the same night. It was really weird. But what I love about revisiting all of the songs that you didn't know Prince made is that they're really, really awesome. I want all of you to go home tonight, go to YouTube, and search for a Prince song called Extra Lovable. It is from 1982. The song is 7 minutes and 50 seconds long. Never saw the light of day. He wrote it for Vanity 6, his like pop side project. Never came to be. But this song is brilliant. And it's one of the ones that he just like threw away. This man is so genius. I went down this hole the other day just listening and watching Prince soundcheck videos on YouTube. Like, there's video of him soundchecking, talking to his band, singing, playing the best guitar since Jimi Hendrix. He's just brilliant. You know, there are albums that people don't know exist. Like, one of my favorites of his was released way, way, way off label. It's called The Rainbow Children. It's beautiful. Find the Prince music that is not Purple Rain. Mm-hmm. Listen to that. It will feed your soul. It's been making me happy so much this week.
So if you follow me on Twitter, you know some about this, but I got to spend this last weekend in New York, which, like Chicago, is a great theater town, you might have heard, going to see Broadway productions. I saw Groundhog Day, which is a new musical. It is the movie, except a musical.
Someone laughed at that.
I enjoy the laugh that's like, really?
It was a great laugh, too.
It is a great laugh. But no, it's from, you know, some of the talent behind like Matilda and some other musicals. The lead in it playing what was the Bill Murray part in the movie. How many of y'all are Law & Order SVU people? So the guy who played Dodds, Andy Carl, is like a fantastic like song and dance Broadway guy, it turns out. He's fantastic in it. It was a delight. It's so much fun. And then I also went to two plays. I went to basically like there are two new plays by women on Broadway this season, and I got to go to both of them. One is called Indecent, and it's a Paula Vogel play. About the production of another play in the 20s. And it's wonderful, and it's so moving. And if you get a chance to see it in New York or elsewhere, please go and see it again. It's called Indecent. And then I saw Sweat by Lynn Nottage, which about 24 hours after I saw it, won the Pulitzer Prize. So
You called it.
Yeah. So if you're out there and you want your play to win the Pulitzer Prize, I am the lucky charm.
Give her some tickets.
I love going to New York and going to theater, and it was such a blessing, and it is such a pleasure to get to see live theater. And I have a theory that I'm working on that I'm probably going to write about at some point, that people who like prestige television, people who have appreciated the move of television into things that are more complicated and significant and sometimes serious and moving, are good candidates to not just go to musicals, like, you know, you're in town, so you go to Hamilton, or you go to Groundhog Day, or you go to, you know, Wicked or Amelie or whatever. Don't just go to a fun musical. Go to a play, not just in New York, but here too, or wherever you live. Go and find plays. They are, I think a lot of times people think plays are going to be dry. They're not dry. Those plays are both just so vibrant and wonderful. I had such a joyful and fantastic experience. I felt so lucky to be able to do that. I was so lucky to be able to do that. So live theater and being in the room with people who are performing, which is something I totally, totally love, is very, very much making me happy this week. And it, of course, links to... Oh my gosh, that was so much fun.
That was a really, really fun discussion and a great crowd.
It was a great crowd. It was such a good show. We had so much fun with W. Kamau Bell and with Sam and everybody. Oh my gosh, it was so much fun. And we do have a lot of people that we need to thank for that show. Back at NPR, our thanks to Anya Grundmann, Neil Carruth, Ali Prescott, Alex McCall, Ellen Silva, Jessica Goldstein, and of course, what's this other name? Oh, Jessica Reedy.
Oh my God, Jessica Reedy.
Jessica Reedy. And from WBEZ, thanks to Tyler Green. Tyler! Mary Kathleen Julian and Caroline Cook. Thanks to W. Kamau Bell, of course, and to our buddy Sam Sanders. And thanks to Mike Katzef, whose band Hello Come In gave us our theme music that we love. And thanks to Mooka Patsa. Holy moly. They performed at our live show in Chicago and also provided us with their song, Dirty Chompers.
Dirty Chompers. If you have not seen Mooka Patsa's Tiny Desk Concert, I highly recommend it.
Look it up. Dirty Chompers. So thanks to Chris Klimek and Gene Demby also for talking about the Fate of the Furious with us. And we will be back next week with a new episode.